biography of the spiritual medium of the 1800 Dismisses. J.H. Conant, Book of 1873. This is partly OCR of Book on Net. TXT errors may be here. Introduction. There are two questions which have followed like phantoms the footsteps of each generation along the years. Is this state of material being all that is in store for us? And if we indeed survive the shock of death, shall we remember those we loved on earth, and be able to make our presence known to them? The great mass of humanity, in whatever age or country, has instinctively repelled the thought of annihilation, although, as a minority idea, it has frequently found existence in peculiarly organized minds. Afterlife, in some form, however crude in its conditions, has been the incentive of all the moral ethics and religious formulas to which time has given birth. It would seem that to him who sincerely questions of his interior consciousness the verity of immortality in hours of twilight or midnight silence, when the toils of the day are done or in the brooding presence of some chilling sorrow, when the loved of earth have passed the bounds of mortal ken, there can be but one answer which comes therefrom, and that is, that the ego, my inner being, is deathless and indestructible. From the earliest dawn of reason as evidenced in the acts of the primitive races, and foreshortened upon the canvas of time by archaeology, man has been convinced in some way, though the process may be inexplicable at times, that he is really twofold in nature, that as the seed in the material world contains the germ of life and the nutritive principle which is to sustain that life till it gains power to draw from the surrounding soil its daily supply, so his body is but the nucleus of higher possibilities, containing in itself a power that is to live after it has exhausted all the vital food which the physical form can offer, by drawing from the soil and atmosphere of a contiguous and higher, though unseen and mystical, country the nutriment which shall expand it to full development. This widespread and intuitive looking for immortality has affirmatively decided the first question. But the correct answer to the companion query concerning the after communication of the so-called dead, while it has been also shadowed upon the traditions and beliefs of all races, and partially embodied in certain religious systems, has not met with the universal acknowledgement among mankind which it merits, in too many cases being arbitrarily placed in abeyance by those who, having charge of the rising generations of the people, educate them to treat the subject from standpoints antagonistic to the use of God's choicest gift, the human reason. Nevertheless, in obedience to the ever-increasing enlightenment of the world, we find in the 19th century the cropping out of a wondrous demonstration of the truth of man's aforetime dim and clouded conceptions or inexplicable evictions. To the hearts of millions in America, England, France, Germany, Russia, and other civilized countries the fact has become patent, through conclusive evidence, both mental and physical, that there is a continued, conscious existence beyond the change called death, and that those in that state of being, but little advanced by the process, ascending only in the seal by subsequent development, from that position to which their conduct while in earth life logically assigned them can identify themselves to those whom they once cherished. This new principle of belief has been designated spiritualism, whose meaning Hayward's Book of All Religions informs us may he stated in a single proposition, that disembodied human spirits sometimes manifest themselves, or make known their presence and power, to persons in the earthly body, and hold realized communication with them. This is the great truth which the present age has given to cheer the whilom dark pathway to the tomb with the glory of a coming world of eternal progression, and to drown the dismal dirge which the somber, cave-arched waves of death's Jordan have chanted for ages gone, with the thrilling music of angelic welcome to life's evergreen hills. Right has found its willing martyrs in every age. Men and women, filled with an irresistible impulse whose source is from above, have in its cause fearlessly dared whatever of physical anguish or mental disquietude the bigots of their day could heap upon them, and in this 19th century many who recognize within them the voice of consecration are, like their prototypes of old, devoting their self-sacrificing labors upon the public rostrum, in the seance, through the columns of the spiritual press, and every avenue in social life, for the advancement of a knowledge of this new revelation among men, without fear and without adequate reward, hoping only for the harvest which their children's eyes shall see. Happy in feeling that who commanded the light to shine out of darkness hath shined into their hearts, knowing that they have this treasure in earthen vessels that the glory may he ascribe to the true source of inspiration, they continue, as does the subject of this sketch, while troubled on every side, yet not distressed, perplexed, but not in despair, to proclaim to a world lost in the glaring wastes of material gain, and misled by erroneous educational guides, God is not dumb, that he should speak no more. If thou hast wanderings in the wilderness and find'st not Sinai, thy soul is poor, there towers the mountain of the voice no less, which whoso seeks shall find, but he who bends intent on manna still, and mortal ends, sees it not, neither hears its thundered law. Biography. The following record has been prepared, that the reader may know somewhat of the strange experiences, deep sufferings, sharp trials, and noble fruits which have attended the lifeline of only a single individual among the many apostles of the new dispensation, and learn to value the gift of spirit communion in proportion to its cost. Francis Ann Crowell was born in Portsmouth, N.H.L., April 28, 1851. Her parents, named Peter and Hannah, respectively, were in moderate circumstances, and at the time of her birth resided on Parker Street, in the western portion of the, then, town. When about the age of 6 years, she commenced attending a private school near her home, kept by Mrs. Leach, a widow lady. This she continued to be connected with for about 18 months, when she entered one of the public schools of the town on Cabot Street, Mr. Blaisdell, preceptor. After the lapse of some months her father removed to another district, the southern part of the town, and she was enrolled among the scholars of Mrs. Marshall, who prepared girls to enter the high school. Owing to sickness she was not able to attend regularly, being kept from her studies nearly half the time. On her attaining the age of 11 she left this school, and never attended any other. The foregoing institutions in Portsmouth, and the limited time spent therein, have been her only opportunities for education, as that word is commonly used. 2. Her mechanistic faculties existed from her earliest years, although for a long time she did not understand what was meant by them. When about 7 years of age, she was prostrated by a fever, and one evening she heard her mother, while watching by her bedside, conversing with some person apparently in the room, who in her bewildered condition she supposed to be one of the neighbors. Finally, rousing herself to partial consciousness, she gazed around the apartment, but failed to see the individual addressed. Her mother, not detecting the movement, and supposing she still slept, continued the conversation. At last childish curiosity gained the ascendancy over weakness, and the little one asked, "Who are you talking with, mother?" "Why, my child," replied her parent, "I thought you were asleep," and she endeavored to turn the attention of the patient to some other subject, but the anxiety of the daughter could not be appeased, and finally her mother said, "Well, my dear, I was talking to the angels." "The angels, mother? I thought they lived in heaven." "Yes, but they sometimes come to talk with us in this world." The future medium, having never been brought face to face with the matter before, was strangely moved, and feared that her mother must have become suddenly deranged. "Who are the angels, mother?" she asked. "The angels, my daughter, are those who once lived on this earth, but who are now called dead. Your little sister is an angel, so you were talking to them?" "Yes. What did they say?" "Your little sister tells me that you are to recover." 3. From that day, like one of old, she kept all these things, and pondered them in her heart, wondering if those scenes and persons she sometimes beheld, though others could not, were really of angelic origin, as the philosophy of her mother would seem to indicate. She heard raps, and saw articles of furniture moved in her room when she knew no mortal hand was there to perform the acts, and she gravely considered these the first premonitory drops of the great shower yet to come, with a depth of interest beyond her years. Her mother, yielding to her importunities, talked frequently with her, explaining the matter as fully as she herself understood it at that early period, 10 years before the accepted date of the advent of modern spiritualism, and prophesied that her daughter would one day know more concerning it. At that time and to the hour of her decease, her mother was a member, in regular standing, of the Chestnut Street Baptist Church, and her friends were sorely troubled at the thought of the wild delusion which had taken possession of Sister Crowell. When her daughter was about 9 years old, Mrs. C. was seized with a severe illness which threatened her life. She grew rapidly worse, and one black midnight the little Fanny was called up by a member of the affrighted household, and told to dress herself with all speed and summon the physician who lived 2 miles away, as her mother was dying. She arose hastily and in youthful trepidation rushed out into the darkness with her bonnet under her arm, a shoe upon one of her feet, and its companion in her hand, she intending to put it on as she journeyed. In her trouble she lost her shoe and her way also, and found herself alone in the broad unsettled suburb outlying the South Road as it is called. She was extremely frightened, and ran rapidly, with a hope of finding some familiar object. Suddenly she fell, and, as she supposed, fainted away, but after experience has shown her that she passed into the state of trance. When she returned to consciousness, or came out of the trance, she saw a tall gentleman standing by her side. She looked at him at first with joy at the hope of finding her way and gaining the physician's house in time to be of assistance to her mother, but there was something in his appearance which filled her with indefinable awe. "You have lost your way, little one," he said, kindly. "Yes, sir," she replied. "Come with me," he continued, "and I will show you where you wish to go." Fear again struggled for the mastery. "He is a stranger to me. How does he know where I wish to go?" queried the child, as she looked earnestly at the luminous form before her. "Is he an angel?" She again supposed she fainted from fright, but was really entranced, and did not recover control of her senses till she found herself at the doctor's door with her guide, where the spirit, for such it really was, informed her that he was Epaminides, an ancient Greek, and that he had come in answer to her prayer. This to her seemed strange, but was true, as she had kept up a mental cry, though she had not spoken it aloud, to the angels, in the midst of her fears, that they would come and help her, and retain her mother in life till she could return to the house. Her efforts were successful. The doctor and a friend her mother desired to see were both summoned, and the failing patient recovered. Fanny often after this occurrence felt the influence of her mysterious friend. She did not always see him, but knew that he was near. For some time after this event, and when she was about 10 years of age, while playing, at the hour of twilight, she suddenly fell in what was pronounced a fit by her medical attendants, and remained in an unconscious condition till 3 o'clock on the following morning. On her returning to a cognizance of surrounding things, her glance fell first upon 2 well-known professional gentlemen, Dr. Cheever, a celebrated physician of Portsmouth, and well-known while in life throughout New England, and Dr. Dwight. The one held a spoon, the other was endeavoring to force her teeth apart sufficiently for the administration of the prepared prescription. She then passed into the trance, and while so conditioned, some spirit, evidently well versed in the intricacies of pharmacological law, gave directions through her lips to the 2 wonderstruck M.D.S., as to what should be done for the betterment of her case. Although the physicians considered this as merely the result of an abnormal state of the brain, yet they acknowledged the edict given, to be astonishingly scientific, and such as it would be well for them to follow, which they did, thus presenting an exhibition of remarkable professional liberality, though it was perfectly in keeping with the general dealings of the fearless gentleman in question. Her sickness at this time proved a serious matter, extending over a period of 6 months, during most of which these physicians attended her. They then gave up the case into the hands of Dr. Goddard, also of Portsmouth. Through all this season of trial, as soon as either physician entered the room the young patient would be entranced, and if he was about to administer anything which her guides, as she afterward learned by increased knowledge of the facts of spirit communion, thought she ought not to have, they, through her organism, would refuse, and make a prescription themselves. All the physicians employed considered her case a most remarkable one. She was visited by Drs. Linton, Kelly, and many others from different parts of New Hampshire and Massachusetts, all of whom were desirous of tracing the workings of the peculiar disease for themselves. These investigators finally came to the conclusion that she was troubled with some new derangement of the brain with which the medical faculty were not yet acquainted. Soon after Fanny's recovery, her mother was again prostrated by sickness, which proved to be her last, and with this event commenced the occurrence of many singular spirit manifestations, both mental and physical in character. So startling were these displays of invisible force, that neither money or friendship would induce persons to stay in the house with the patient. As soon as the disturbances began, away ran everyone in mortal fright, leaving upon the daughter the entire burden of household duties and the care of her afflicted parent. When she was about 11 years of age, this period of anxious and self-devoting labor drew to a close, and her parent, slowly sinking, passed the reaches of mortality. A few days previous to her decease, she called the little one to her bedside, and said, "Fanny, I am going to leave you," upon which the sad-faced child cried out, "Oh, take me with you." "No, my dear," replied the mother, "God has a wondrous work for you to do in after years, and you must stay here and perform it." Fanny had been before impressed to feel a vague outlining of some remarkable course in life reserved for her, but nothing definitive had been portrayed, and she again said, "Oh, how can I do anything without a mother?" "My dear," answered the parent, "the angels will be your father and mother. When you come to meet me in heaven, bring me a clear record that you have always obeyed them. You will know more concerning this by and by." In after time, when the child had grown to womanhood, and was present at her first understood spiritual seance, the remembrance of that mother's prophecy, coming to her like the echo of a refrain across the years, was the great cause of her assenting to the demands of the spirit world as expressed by Dr. Fisher. At the time of her mother's decease, raps were heard and electric lights seen in the chamber, and the child medium was frequently entranced. Indeed, so much of her vitality was consumed previous to this event in supplying the needs of the sinking one, that when those attending took her away from the cold form of her arisen parent, she herself was, as she expresses it, nearer dead than alive. During her mother's departure from the form, the little one beheld a strange vision, unseen to others in the room, akin to that which has so often been portrayed since by clairvoyants, but which at that time she failed to understand. Andrew Jackson Davis, the wonderful seer, has beautifully described the process in his recent work, Ter Strem Per, as seen by himself on other occasions in after years. Death is the word used to signify the end of life, spoken by persons who see not that seeming death is really the beginning of life, and the opening of the sacred volume of eternity. But let us peer through the seeming, into that which is within the yeal. The person is now dying, and it is to be a rapid death. Observe something about temperature. The feet are cold, the hands hot and white, a coldness pervades the entire cuticle. See? What is that accumulating in the atmosphere just over the pillowed head? It is an ethereal emanation, a golden magnetic halo, a throbbing, almost self-conscious atmosphere. The bodily temperature is now lowering rapidly. The coldness has extended upward from the toes to the knees, and from the fingertips to the elbows, while, in exactly the same ratio, the emanation has ascended higher over the head. The arms are now cold to the shoulders, and legs to the hips, and the emanation, although not higher in the air, is more expanded, with a compact white center, resembling the bright nucleus of a miniature sim. This brilliant central spot is, in very truth, the brain of the new spiritual organism now forthcoming. The death cold steals over the heaving breast, and around on either side the temperature is greatly diminished. Look now, The psychic emanation contains some proportion of every principle composing the soul, motion, life, sensation, ethers, essences, vital magnetism, vital electricity, instincts, and, much enlarged Heok sessions, it has floated up in a compact mass, and now occupies a higher altitude near the ceiling. Now the lungs have ceased to breathe, the pulse is still, the physical heart is motionless, while the brain cells, the corpus callosum, the medulla, and the spinal cord and ganglia, are ablaze with contractive and expansive energies, which gently pulsate and seem to direct and govern themselves by a kind of automatic self-consciousness. C. The negative, gray, substance of the brain is interiorly throbbing, a slow, measure, profoundly deep throb, not painful, but massive and harmonious like the deep heartbeat of the sea. Look up, the exalted emanation, obedient to its own changeless laws, is now elongated, and has attained a position at right angles with the horizontal body below. Behold! See how the outline of a beautiful human form is being fashioned within that emanation. Beneath it is still tied by a white life cord to the medulla and the corpus callosum within the brain. You observe that a very fine vitally thread still connects the vortices and central fibers of the dying brain with the lower extremities of the exalted outlined human being in the atmosphere. Notwithstanding the existence of this life thread, which acts like a telegraphic conductor, conveying messages in opposite directions at the same moment, you observe that the shadowy image, enveloped in a golden emanation, continues almost imperceptibly to ascend skyward. There. What do I now see? A symmetrically shaped human head rising above the mass, slowly, beautifully rising out of the golden cloud of substantial principles. And now appear the outlines of a spiritual countenance, a quiet face and full of beauty, surpassing the power of words to delineate. Look again. Behold emerging the fair neck and gorgeous shoulders, and see. As we gaze, out come, one after the other, in rapid succession, as if influenced and directed by the wonderful magician, all the parts of a new body, a bright, natural-looking, yet spiritual image only a little less than the deserted physical body, a perfect reappearance of the person in the immediate heavens, prepared to accompany the celestial group of superintending intelligences to the Summerland. What was that? In the twinkling of an eye the vitalic electrical telegraphic thread was snapped. The yet lingering particles and principles were suddenly attracted upward and absorbed into the spiritual body, and lo! The new organization is free of terrestrial gravitations, is instantly and absolutely independent of the weights and cares that chained it firmly imprisoned to Earth. Those only are free at death who have lived righteously. Any enthralling passion, the least feeling of duty undischarged, of injustice committed, holds the spirit to earth, as a ship is fastened by a heavy anchor. Only the pure are free. Here now behold a true, substantial, immortal, spiritual body. It was sown in darkness and dishonor, it is raised in beauty and brightness. Behold the contrast, the vastly wide difference, between the interior and outward. Cast your eyes around the room. There are many friends, aged relatives, and little children, in the death chamber. They mourn, without the comfort even of blind faith. They grieve, with only the whisperings of hope to the doubting car. They gather around the prostrate, cold body, they press together the lids of the sightless eyes, in silence and in sorrow they withdraw from the scene. And now other hands commence those final preparations with which the living consecrate the dead. But let us open our brighter eyes, the eyes that we shall all have when clothed with the deathless garment of immortality. See. The newly organized spiritual body, surrounded by a group of guardian angels, moves gracefully off in the direction of celestial shores. The arisen personality follows a vibrating thread of magnetic attraction, which while the dying mutations were in process we noticed penetrating the apartment and fastening itself to the earthly brain of the resurrected. It comes floating down from the sensorium of superior intelligences, a golden fibrillous stream of telegraphic light, sent from on high, to greet with love and guide with wisdom the newly arisen. The thought-laden loy thread tranquilly draws the newborn higher up and farther away. Over the velvet lands in flower fields of the celestial country the bending bow of eternal promise is visible, filling with indescribable beauty the boundless ocean of world-laden skies, which cover with infinite loveliness the immeasurable zone lands of the hereafter. Here, then, in that lonely sick room at Portsmouth, years before the world had heard this voice that lifted the veil, youth, the perpetual counterpart and companion of old age, endeavored to cheer the lonely traveler, and the young child, whose name was destined to be known among the friends of liberal thought the world over, hung with breathless earnestness over the form of a mother in a physical sense soon to be no more. She tells us that she saw the brilliant emanation rise and stand above the body. I thought it was an angel, but it looked like my mother. When she turned to go away she appeared to know me, and gazed so kindly upon me, yet she seemed anxious to go, and I was much frightened. The room was full of spirits, some strange faces, and some whom I had known while on earth. Though she sometimes saw her mother, as other departed ones, by means of her spiritual perceptions, it was not until she was 22 years of age that she received a message from her through the organism of another medium. Vi her father gave in his adhesion to no form of religion, being opposed to the same in every shape, but thought, at the time of his wife's decease, that some clergyman should be summoned to attend her funeral. As before stated, Mrs. Crowell was a member in regular standing in the Baptist Church, though she had, previous to her death, fallen under the shade of the priestly ban by reason of the strange manifestations occurring at her house, which were denominated by her neighbors dealings with the devil. When his daughter asked who was to be the parson summoned for the observance of the last rites, Peter replied, "I suppose her minister. Do you know where he lives?" "Yes," replied Fanny, whereupon she was directed to go and request him to attend. She repaired to his residence. But when the trembling child announced her errand, he positively refused to officiate as pastor on the occasion, because of the dealings aforesaid. Directly, she says, I felt an entire change in my feelings, a strong disgust took possession of me, together with a desire to kick the reverend bigot, in fact, I do not know what restrained me from it. I left the house and sat down upon the doorstep outside, wondering what I should do. While I sat there, the same noble presence who met me on the night when I lost my way several years before while, looking for a physician for my mother, appeared to me, and said, kindly, little one, go to Mr. Robinson, the Methodist preacher, he will come. But, said I don't know him, or where he lives. I will show you, replied the spirit. She was then thrown into a trance as before, and on regaining consciousness, found herself at the door of the minister's residence. She called for the gentleman, and when she had explained her errand, and told the manner in which she had been treated by the Baptist clergyman, Mr. Robinson exclaimed, with hearty indignation, "My dear, I am almost ashamed to acknowledge that I live in this age. Certainly I will go to your mother's funeral." He did attend, and performed the services in a manner at once soothing and sympathetic. 7. Her father procured a housekeeper, and the tide of life bore the little lonely one along upon its breast to the fulfillment of her mission. She used frequently to see spirits, and sometimes heard their voices as plainly as those of mortals. She was frequently very much frightened because those she saw were strangers. At intervals she was cheered by the sight of her mother. There was no one to reveal to this isolated child more of the mystery of the law of communion than her mother had given her in the conversations upon the subject, had while she was on earth, for spiritualism had not yet dawned with healing in its wings, and with but few marked exceptions the spirits seen by her seemed as ignorant as herself of the proper methods of expression to be used. When she arrived at the age of 15 years, for her the current of life deepened, and she was launched upon the sea of active labor. She left her childhood home by the winding Piscataqua, and went to Lowell, Mass. Where she engaged herself as a tailoress, working at that business till she attained the age of 20, when she was united in marriage with John H. Conant, a grandson of Piarov. John Hubbard, of Dartmouth College.